Welcome to our panel today, Missed Connections. My name is Dawn Tripp, and I'm thrilled to be moderating this session with Celeste Ng, Eshkol Nevo, and Lily Tuck. These three novels are phenomenal books, taught, thrilling, revelatory, wise. I love that I can say that these are books that should be bought and shared and read. They're masterful works of literary art, and to me as a writer and also as a reader, that matters. I'm going to introduce each of our panelists and share a brief description of each book, and then each one is going to read a very short passage from their novel so you can get a sense of the voice of the work. Celeste Ng's second novel, Little Fires Everywhere, is a New York Times bestseller. It's an exquisite, incandescent work of fiction that explores the violent undercurrents of tension in a progressive, neatly ordered American town. In Shaker Heights, a quiet suburb of Cleveland, everything is planned. From the layout of the roads to the colors of the houses to the successful lives its residents will go on to lead. And no one embodies this spirit more than Elena Richardson, whose guiding principles is playing by the rules. Enter Mia Warren, enigmatic artist and single mother who arrives in Shaker Heights with her teenage daughter, Pearl, and rents a house from the Richardsons. Soon, Mia and Pearl become more than tenants. All four Richardson children are drawn to the mother-daughter pair. But Mia carries with her a mysterious past and a disregard for the status quo that threatens to upend the carefully curated lives in this community. When the Richardson's friends attempt to adopt a Chinese-American baby, a custody battle erupts that dramatically divides the town and puts Mia and Elena on opposing sides. Elena is determined to uncover the secrets in Mia's past, but her obsession will come at unexpected, devastating costs. Little Fires Everywhere has received a landslide of praise, rave reviews from the New York Times Book Review, The Wall Street Journal, Glamour, Vogue, Marie Claire, Booklist, and many others. The Boston Globe describes Little Fires Everywhere as a complex and compulsively readable suburban saga, deeply invested in mothers and daughters. What Ng has written in this thoroughly entertaining novel is a pointed and persuasive social critique, teasing out the myriad forms of privilege and predation that stand between so many people and their achievement of the American dream. This is also a book that believes in the transformative power of art and genuine kindness, and in the promise of new growth even after devastation, even after everything has turned to ash. So if you could just read a brief passage.
I'm reading now.
That would be great. Thank you.
We were told to read just a paragraph, so I'm just going to read you the first paragraph. Everyone in Shaker Heights was talking about it that summer, how Isabel, the last of the Richardson children, had finally gone around the bend and burned the house down. All spring, the gossip had been about little Mirabel McCullough, or, depending on which side you were on, Mei Ling Chow. And now, at last, there was something new and sensational to discuss. A little after noon on that Saturday morning in May, the shoppers pushing their grocery carts in Heinen's heard the fire engines wail to life and careen away toward the duck pond. By a quarter after 12, there were four of them parked in a haphazard red line along Parkland Drive, where all six bedrooms of the Richardson house were ablaze, and everyone within a half mile could see the smoke rising over the trees like a dense black thundercloud. Later, people would say that the signs had been there all along, that Izzy was a little lunatic, that there had always been something off about the Richardson family, that as soon as they heard the sirens that morning, they knew something terrible had happened. By then, of course, Izzy would be long gone, leaving no one to defend her, and people could, and did, say whatever they liked. At the moment the fire trucks arrived, though, and for quite a while afterward, no one knew what was happening. Neighbors clustered as close to the makeshift barrier as they could and watched the firemen unreel their hoses with the grim faces of men who recognized a hopeless cause. Across the street, the geese at the pond ducked their heads underwater for weeds, wholly unruffled by the commotion.
Thank you. In Three Floors Up, best-selling and award-winning Israeli author Eshkol Nevo sets three short novella-length chapters in an upper-middle-class Tel Aviv apartment building. This book is a gorgeous, incisive exploration of the interwoven lives of its residents, whose turmoil, secrets, unreliable confessions, and dangerous choices reveal a society in the midst of crisis. On the first floor, Arnon, a tormented retired officer who fought in the First Intifada, confesses to an army friend how his obsession with his young daughter's safety led him to lose control and put his marriage in peril. On the second floor lives Hanai? Yeah, we talked about pronouncing Hani. Yeah. Known as the widow, whose husband travels the world for his lucrative job while she stays at home with their two children, increasingly isolated and unstable. When her brother-in-law appears at their door begging her to hide him from loan sharks and the police, she agrees in spite of the risk to her family. On the top floor, a recently retired judge, Devorah, remains in the apartment she shared with her late husband. Keenly feeling his absence and trying to reconnect with her estranged son, she joins a social movement and is drawn to a man who is not what he seems. Vivid and lucent, Three Floors Up depicts the grinding effects of social and political ills played out in the psyches of these flawed, compelling characters, often in unexpected and explosive ways. Three Floors Up has been widely acclaimed by Booklist, Library Journal, Kirkus, the Jerusalem Post, and the Jewish Book Council, among others. The Jewish News Service praises the novel as a compelling critique of Israeli society. Nevo's strength lies in his ability to fashion wonderfully relatable characters whose troubled voices, as well as mysterious and impulsive moods, render the work a page-turner. So you read a passage for us? Thank you.
So Hani is alone at home, and there's a knock on the door. And on the other side, there's a fugitive, and she decides to give him refuge. But I'm avoiding the subject, I know. And the question is, why? Why did I let him stay when the list of pros and cons that Nomi's mother told us to make every time we are undecided were all cons? I know that 99% of women caught in a similar situation would have thrown Eviatar out, if only because of their simple concern for their children. So why was I in the remaining 1%? If anyone touches even the edge of the tip of Liri's or Nimrod's fingernail, I attack them like a tiger. When Liri was in the first grade, some kid named Itamar used to bully her at recess. So I went to the school at around 10, told the guard that Liri forgot her sandwich, so he'd let me in, went over to that Itamar and told him that if he bullied Liri one more time, I'd make shakshuka out of him. That's the word that came out of my mouth, shakshuka. So what happened that made me let Eviatar in? The truth is that I don't know, Neta. It's just that sometimes all your insides scream the command at you. Do the wrong thing. Do the wrong thing.
From National Book Award winner Lily Tuck, Sisters is a subversive short novel of jealousy and desire that tells the story of a new marriage from its surprising inception through its provocative denouement. Tuck's unnamed narrator lives with her new husband, his two teenagers, and the unbanishable presence of his first wife, known only as She. In oblique short episodes, the narrator moves through her own world, curious about the all-too-real ghost of the first marriage, fantasizing about how the first wife lives her life. Will the narrator ever equal the first wife intellectually? Will she ever forget her own deceit or her husband's betrayal that lies between them? The daring and precise buildup to an eerily wonderful conclusion makes this spare novel a triumph of subtlety and surprise. With Sisters, Lily Tuck delivers a riveting psychological portrait of marriage, infidelity, and obsession. Sisters has been widely praised by the New York Times Book Review, Elle Magazine, the Minneapolis Star Tribune, Kirkus, and many, many others. A starred review in Publishers Weekly describes Sisters as elegant, raw, and powerful. This succinct book builds an emotional intensity to a shocking ending. Though compact enough to read in one sitting, it is also magnificent enough to be reread and savored. And the Boston Globe describes Sisters as a minimalist masterpiece, a tight knot of a novel filled with intertextual puzzles, pathos, and happy rewards.
Wow. I'm going to be brave and hopefully not shock you. And there are no children here, right? Sometimes when I could not sleep, many nights actually, I have insomnia. Instead of counting sheep, I tried to count the number of times during their marriage that they had made love. I was just guessing, of course, but for argument's sake, let's say that for the first 2 years, they were both young, in their 20s. They made love nearly every night. So call that 1,000 fucks. Then, the third and fourth year, maybe they made love only two or three times a week. So let's call that 300 fucks. And then, of course, it got less. Also, she had had two kids in between. So again, if they made love two or three times a week, for the next 8 or 9 years, that made it about 800 fucks. And probably towards the end of their marriage, they didn't fuck at all. So I was guessing that she and my husband fucked about 2,000 times during their marriage. As for me and my husband, we were older. He was in his 40s. We fucked a lot the first year, and after that, we only fucked once or twice a week, and usually only on Sunday mornings.
So in each of these books, an obsession takes root, an obsession that becomes a driving force in the narrative. And obsession is always so curious to me because it seems to me to have this double edge. It's a force that throws a person or a situation out of balance. It can be a force that destroys, but it can also shed a powerful light on our deepest hungers and our fears. So it can also have a component that's ultimately revelatory. So I would love for each of you to talk a little bit about how obsession drives your story, or how it drove you to come to your, to come to the particular story you chose to tell.
I think writers are obsessed anyway, so obsession comes naturally. The real kernel for this book was that I read a wonderful book by somebody called Christopher Nicholson. The book is called Winter, and it's about Thomas Hardy's last years. And he became obsessed with a young woman. He sort of fell madly in love with her in a way. Her name was Gertrude, something like Guttel. I mean, not a very pretty name, but and she was supposed to play Tessa Hardy in the sort of local theater. And meanwhile, Hardy's second wife, a woman called Florence, was sort of very unhappy about Thomas Hardy being obsessed with this young woman, and also unhappy because Thomas Hardy kept writing love poems to his first wife, who had died, and he dragged poor old Florence to the cemetery to every anniversary of Emma, the first wife's death. And at one point, Florence thinks, First and second wives are like sisters. And that really rang a huge bell for me. And I stopped doing what I was working on another book and wrote this book really fast because I felt I sort of had to write about this. And just the idea that first and second wives are like sisters became sort of not an obsession, but it was something that that just interested me. And just for clarity, I've been a first and second wife, although I don't think that this book is at all autobiographical.
So, thank you.
You were talking about writing love letters to the dead wife.
Yeah.
So in my book, there's a woman who leaves messages at the answering machine to her dead husband. Mm-hmm. She finds the answering machine after he dies, and when you plug in the answering machine, you can still hear his voice saying, "Hello, you have reached the Adelman family."
Yeah.
And she gets addicted to leaving messages to her dead husband. Now, she tells him what happened since he died, and she also settles unsettled business with him. Now, you can think of it as an obsession. It's an obsessive act. But actually, I think what is fascinating about obsessions is that there's a truth in them.
Right.
Because we cannot say goodbye. It's really hard to say goodbye to loved ones. So it's an obsessive act, but it has a lot of truth in it, I guess. Well, this is why I was attracted to this character. And actually, all the characters in this book are confessing about obsessions in a way. And all of them, there are moments that you can think, well, they are obsessive people, and yeah, they're not me, I'm not this. But then you understand that if someone is really caring about his daughter and what happened to her while she was at a babysitter, then we can connect to that. Mm-hmm. And if someone lets a fugitive in her house because she's really, really lonely, it's obsessive, but we can connect to that. So I'm interested in this thin line between obsessiveness and truth, and something which is quite human.
Yeah, great.
Yeah, I really agree. I think that writers, as Lily said, tend to be somewhat obsessive people, that there are these ideas that we get and we kind of keep worrying over them until there's something inside them that we don't understand that we're trying to get out. But I think it's not just a writer thing. I think it is really a human impulse that a lot of times there's something about us that connects to whatever it is that we're obsessed with. And a lot of what drives the obsession, I think, is us trying to figure out what that connection is, whether it's something that we love or whether it's something that we hate, or at least we think we hate. There's something that's resonating between those two things. And a lot of times, I think that's what leads us in life to kind of go what often is called the obsessive route. But also in fiction, I think, is what drives us to write the stories that we keep thinking about. For me, I'm always writing towards something that I don't understand. And because I don't understand it, I can't stop thinking about it. That's often, I think, where the how the obsession drives me. And so in my novel, there are two mothers who are sort of friendly but are sort of rivals with each other. And one of them in particular becomes sort of obsessed with the other one. She thinks that they're complete opposites, and yet for whatever reason, she can't stop sort of digging into this woman's past. And I think that happens much more often than maybe we'd like to admit. We like to think of it as like, oh, that's pathological, but I'm just fine. But I think about a friend of mine who is a mom, and she said to me one day that she's like, you know what being a mother is? I woke up this morning thinking about my son's toenails and whether I needed to cut them. And I sort of laughed, but I also knew what she meant, that there's this idea that there's something that's always in the back of your head, that, you know, to somebody who doesn't have children and maybe doesn't ever worry about cutting their toenails, this sounds crazy. And yet when you have been in that situation, it makes utter sense. It's sort of like you said, there's a very fine line there.
Mm-hmm.
So a review of your novel, Celeste in Vogue, wrote about how Little Fires Everywhere takes unerring aim at upper middle class America's blind spots. In a nuanced study of mothers and daughters and the burden of not belonging to our families or our communities. And for me as a reader, part of the driving force of each of these three novels is a kind of stealth revelation of our blind spots, the blind spots of the characters, but also our blind spots as readers, or our blind spots as readers looking to connect with these characters, kind of delineating, each of these books is delineating that the parameters of that territory of what we know, what we see, and what we don't want to see. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that in relationship to each of these stories.
Yeah, I'm always sort of fascinated by the ways that people understand each other or don't understand each other, the ways that they connect unexpectedly, or the ways that when you expect somebody who you know really well is totally going to get you and they completely don't. That's just something that I'm realizing is sort of a through line in a lot of my work. And one of the things that I realized that this novel, Little Fires Everywhere, was about is sort of what happens when the mother that you have isn't quite the mother that you need, or who doesn't get you in some way. In my own life, I feel like there are times when I talk to my mother or my sister or a very good friend, and I think that they're going to get me, and they just think that I'm obsessive or crazy, or they're like, "Yeah, I don't really understand your thing with that, but it's fine." And then there are the moments too, I think, that we often have where you meet someone and they kind of get you. You make a joke and they get it, or you see something that's strange on the T and you look at a stranger and you kind of nod at each other and you both laugh because you've shared this sort of weird moment of connection. We both saw that and it was both weird. You know, we both thought it was weird. And I'm really sort of fascinated by the way that those two things intersect with each other and the ways that they don't always play out. Those connections don't always happen in the places that we expect them, and they do happen in other places that are really sort of marvelous and surprising.
Yeah.
I thought about the blind spot I had in the creative process of this book. When it was first published in Israel, I had a meeting with bookstore managers, and they're used to, you know, to meeting me and hearing stories about the creative process and why did I write the book and what was the background. And I told them, look, it's a book with confession. Confession, so I also have to confess, I don't know where this book came from, and even more embarrassing, I'm not sure what this book is about. And if you can help me, you can ask questions, I will read and save me. Now, you are meeting me 2 years later, and I think I already understand. I had to be blind in a way to the fact that this book is dealing with parenthood, with the dark sides of parenthood, which is, you know, it's a subject I'm living. I have three daughters. I'm into this. I think I had to be blind to the fact that I'm writing about. I told myself another story in order to be able to write such a bold text.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
Again, because the title is Sisters, I mean, I feel like, you know, E.M. Foster, only connect. I mean, I think in this book, the second wife really would like to connect with the first wife, maybe not become her best friend, but have a sense of her, have know more about her. And I don't have too much else to say except that.
Well, and part of the way the novel is structured is that they're, because it's written, and we'll talk a little bit more about this later, but because it's written in that fractured elliptical
right.
way, as a reader, I felt that what I didn't know, like, was just drawing me through the book. So it's that sense as a reader that there's something stealth kind of stalking up behind me, some
yeah.
truth that I'm about to uncover. And because the narrator has this, you know, this elliptical but also restrained and measured, potent way of kind of revealing.
But I think
she's reckoning with.
But I think that's part of my style. I mean, I hardly describe anything.
She's new, Lily.
Nobody, you don't know what color hair anybody has or what their clothes maybe, you know, a little bit more, but you don't know what they look like really. Well, I do describe that she has a Michelangelo type nose, the kind of nose that bridge. Has no bridge. But otherwise, I really don't describe much. I like for the reader to fill in for themselves, really,
right.
yeah. And I think the more you describe, the more you're sort of, I don't know, dumbing down the process.
So in a powerful interview with you, Eshkol, that I read in American Jewish World, you spoke about how part of being a writer is seeing the other side, trying to give voice to the other, to the narrative that is not heard. And in each of these books, you're each exploring the effects of shifting social mores and unrest through the unraveling stories and the evolving stories and psyches of these characters. So these novels illuminate the burden that 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 can come with a lack of connection and a sense of not belonging, exile and estrangement, you know, from our communities, sometimes in our closest relationships and from ourselves or some buried part of our history. So can you talk a little bit about how, you know, that informed, you know, one of the characters or the arc of one of the characters in your story?
I'll talk about the Israeli society and the family concept in Israeli society. It's a very family-oriented society. Everybody is in a family, is part of a family, misses a family. If you're not in a family, you are considered an outcast. So it's a very Jewish kind of attitude towards this subject. But there are a lot of untold stories about, for instance, what happens in the third floor, about unfunctioning families, about what happens when you cannot deal with your own son. Mm-hmm. What happens? And people do not talk about it. The third floor was adapted to theater in Israel, and it was amazing to see how many people came to me and came to the main actress who was playing Devorah, the mother that cannot deal with her son, and told her, "Well, I felt the same, but it's a taboo. I never felt I could talk about it." So I think, you know, literature could be liberating in that sense. And this is part of what we do as writers. We shed a light on dark places.
In my novel, one of the characters really is the community that these two families are living in, Shaker Heights, which is a real suburb, and it is a planned community. Everything in it is sort of very carefully arranged, and it's got sort of this idealism that makes people think that as long as they sort of follow the rules and they plan everything out, that they can kind of make a perfect little corner. And part of the conflict in the book has to do with this mother and daughter who come from out of town who don't fit into that sort of community and who are kind of transgressing all of the nice, neat lines and categories that this community has set up. That they, she's a single mother, they move around a lot, so they're kind of not, you know, they're not stable and upright. And, you know, she's an artist, so she doesn't have exactly a stable profession. And yet at the same time, by sort of throwing into question all of those categories that this community has sort of really valued, this mother and daughter are making everyone in the community kind of question their understanding of how the world is supposed to work. And that's sort of what shakes things up. And so I think it is sort of that, you talked about it as an exile, and I didn't think about it that way, but I think that relates to the book, is that this... when you're in exile, I think you are constantly trying to figure out the relationship between the person that you think you are and the place that you've come from and the place that you're currently in, and kind of negotiate that. And I think that's very much what's happening in the book. The mother and daughter trying to figure out how to relate to their new community, and the community is trying to figure out how they're going to form themselves around this interloper.
Right. I'd love to hear from you, because one of the things that I found so compelling in Sisters is how the second wife, you know, there's a kind of growing sense of estrangement between her and her in her marriage, mm-hmm. but right. also between her and the whole concept of what it is to be a wife.
I mean, I think she makes a big effort to fit in. She tries to get along with the kids, and she does. I mean, too much in the end. But I don't know about concept of marriage, because I mean, the husband is obviously he's not faithful. So I mean, I don't think they represent marriage per se or anything.
But even just her curiosity and her, you know, kind of that incisive fascination that she has for the first wife, she's questioning her marriage, but my takeaway was she was also questioning the whole concept of what it means to be a wife.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I loved it. I love that.
Well, I'm very happy that you have
that. I love it.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's interesting what people read into a book that the writer had never
didn't
thought.
Didn't necessarily. Yet. Well, but you know, a work is. I've been thinking a lot about
but
this.
But I think that's
a work is always this interaction between a writer and a reader. There's always this, you know, and you write. You sit in your room and you write on your own. And your book, when it's published, it goes out to hundreds of readers or thousands of readers at once. But at the end of the day, it's that one-to-one relationship.
But I also think what I tried to say earlier is that the less you say, the more you keep it open to different possibilities.
Right. Yeah, I feel like this goes to what we were chatting about right before we came out, is the idea of sort of like the white space on the page. And clearly that's one of the things that I love about your book, is that part of what it does is it allows space for the reader to come in and figure out how these pieces go together. And we were talking earlier about how much work happens in that white space, and it made me think of what you were saying with it, you know, that you don't describe, because that allows the reader to come in and fill
right.
in those things,
right.
and that's, I feel like that's, right. we talk about blind spots as if they're a bad thing that we haven't filled in that part of the canvas, but I feel like sometimes that's the space that we leave for the reader to come in and layer over their own experience and meaning.
And you wouldn't deny, I mean, there's a growing sense of transgression.
Right.
Like
right.
in this,
yes.
you know, in
right.
this woman's,
right.
you know, journey through this. I mean, there's kind of like that, and there's a kind of multiplicity of transgression.
Right, right.
And that's fascinating. Your work has been, you've been described as a genius with moments.
Yeah.
And your work compared...
Hi.
Your work compared to two of my favorite novelists. Marguerite Yourcenar and Marguerite Duras, and moments in their work, as in yours, are brought forward again by that white space, by that, you know, that bold choice to not write everything
right.
I mean, onto the page.
I think The Lover by Marguerite Duras is one of my favorite books. I mean, again, it's all very, very spare, and she really doesn't spell things out at all.
But sometimes what happens is that it's... you know, the explosiveness happens, the explosions happen in those white spaces. Mm-hmm. And that really, you know, that really allows the narrative to, you know, and you have that also in the ending of the first section is where it really spoke to me. There's an ending and you just feel like you're falling off a cliff,
mm-hmm.
Which is a kind of a gratifying feeling, actually, when you're a reader. And yeah. and Celeste, also, you're working with that in ways, like particularly towards the end of your novel, where there are these moments of, if I had made a different choice, if she had made a different choice, if she had said something different, for a number of the characters.
Yes.
Yeah.
No, I like the reading of that. I feel like, again, that's the sort of space where... It's been interesting. I've been a book tour for the past month or so, and people will come up and they really want to know sort of like, well, what happens after the end of the book?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Which I think I take as a compliment, but I also feel like that's the space where I have to leave the reader and the writer, or the reader and the book, rather, to sort of form their own relationship with each other. Because if the writer spells out all of those things, and in some ways there's no work for the reader to do. It's sort of pre-digested for them, and that takes away a lot of the joy. At least I find as a reader that part of the joy for me is filling in those gaps and putting together those pieces. And I feel like the writer often needs to back out of that that relationship.
I think open endings gets you into trouble with readers. In Israel specifically, readers are very emotional and outgoing, and they come to my readings to complain about the endings.
Yeah.
And I think to myself, well, if 5 years after the book was published, they are still complaining about the end and troubled, maybe I did a good job. Maybe it's working. And in this book specifically, it's kind of a projective, like the Rorschach, the psychological
right.
projective test. Every reader projects his own standards and values. And it's also fascinating. I thought about what you talked about, the way the book is rewritten by the reader, or reread. It also changes culturally from country to country. This is really new in the United States, only a week, but it has been published around the world. And for instance, Arnon, which is the first floor, is an aggressive guy. He was even aggressive for my Israeli readers. But then I went to Italy, and for them, he was just an Italian guy. Yeah, it's normal. There's nothing special about it. So, yeah, it changes from place to place.
The endings of all three of these books, also, they're startlingly potent endings. And I believe in endings, but not necessarily that they have to be tied up, but the ending is the thing that allows the story to stay alive in the mind and the psyche of a reader, you know, long after you've put the book away. Are you driven by endings, or is an ending something you write to discover? Do you need that torque of discovery in order to write the ending well on the page?
I was going to say something about earlier, sort of the... and at the risk of sounding very cranky, I think readers forget that characters are just words on the page. You know, they're just words. They're not real.
You think?
Yes.
Oh, I don't know if I agree with that.
Yeah. I see what you mean, and yet at the same time, I think that that's a pretty limited definition of being real. I guess what I'm thinking about is sort of like if you have a dream, the things in the dream didn't happen, but a lot of times you wake up and if you've had a terrible dream, you still feel that. Or if you have a dream, I don't know if this ever happens to any of you, but if you have a dream that like you are in love with someone or someone is in love with you and you wake up in the morning and they're just, you know, your neighbor or, you know, whatever's happened, those feelings are not real and yet you still have an imprint. So I think that to say that, you know, it doesn't, even if those people are not walking around with us, it doesn't mean that they haven't had an impact on us.
Well, you're trying to write about a truth or to convey a truth or convey people as truly as you can, but at the same time, they're not real.
Yeah.
they're words.
And
words.
This is what I'm trying to tell people, right, too, that when they say things like, well, what does, you know, what kind of, like, shoes does this character wear? I'm like, I don't know. That, because that part isn't part of what's important about them to me.
Right. No.
Yeah.
Anyway. Right.
You were asking about endings. And I thought I have to tell a story about Boston. It's a Boston story. I haven't been in the city for 18 years. And the last time I was here, my parents were at a sabbatical. And I was writing my first book, my first collection of short stories. And I was missing the end. I could not find the way to end the book. And you probably know it's painful. It's physically painful. We're always missing is the ending, but you cannot find it. And I was, you know, staying with my parents in Boston, and I had a jet lag. And I woke up in the middle of the night, and I went to the computer, and I finally understood the end of my first book. So Boston has a really important part in my writing career.
Boston, the city of endings.
But it's endings are it's really tough. It's really tough because it's the most meaningful point in the book. This is what you leave the reader with, and I'm working on a new novel now, and I'm struggling with the end and writing and rewriting, and five or six options and not able to choose. It's really important. It's really a moment to stay on.
Did you have a sense of the end?
I did, but largely because I can't get started on a project until I have an idea of where it's going. I don't always go there, but I have at least a direction that I'm heading in, and I think. I've only done this twice now, but Eshkol, I really like what you were saying about how readers came to complain to you about the endings, because I've gotten a share of that myself. And I realize that often for me, the ending is not the moment at which I provide the answer, but at the moment at which, like, for myself, I've most completely articulated the questions that I've been trying to ask in the book. And often when I'm trying to write an answer and say, and here is the answer, and tie it up, it's never successful. And so I definitely have felt that same feeling of struggling, of feeling like there's something in you that you can't get out.
Yeah, I mean, very often I circle back to the very beginning and have the ending be like the beginning, but something has changed dramatically.
As it has.
Yes.
In the end of
your
book.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Great. So I'd like to open up to questions from you. I think we have about 10 or 15 minutes left. Hang on, we have two pass microphones, so we're going to wait till the microphones arrive.
This is for Celeste Eng. I was interested in that you actually used a real place as the location, as the setting for your book. And I was wondering if, A, there'd been any response from the good people of Shaker Heights, and, B, why you chose that instead of giving it a fictional name.
So I'll answer the first part of the question first, which is that I haven't yet gone home to do my reading in my hometown. That's happening in about 2 weeks. I was scheduled to go to Shaker Heights, which several people have come up to me on tour and said, so this is a real place. And I said, it really is. I live there. I had been scheduled to do it earlier, and I needed to reschedule it. And so instead of being one of the first stops on my book tour, it is ended up being the last out-of-town stop. But what I found so far is that I think at every event that I've gone to, there has been somebody who has very close ties to Shaker Heights, who grew up there, who lives there now, whose parent lives there, whatever. And they say with this kind of sort of self-embarrassed, like, eye roll, yeah, this is pretty accurate. So I'm hoping that they, you know, the community will also sort of see it as the loving portrait that it's intended. The second half of the question, which is why I set it in a real place instead of, you know, making it sort of a made-up place or a fictionalized place, was that the seed of the book really came out of wanting to write about this very particular place that I had grown up in, that had a lot of kind of weird tensions and contradictions in it, that it's very sort of progressive and idealistic, almost hippie-ish, and yet at the same time they're very, very anal about all of their rules. And the more I learned sort of about the history of the place, the more it seemed important to keep it in that particular place and acknowledge the history that had actually happened there and the roots of this community and all the things that had happened. And so once I started getting a sense of that community, I couldn't make it up, or else it would just be like Shaker Heights under a very slightly different name. And keeping it, acknowledging that it was a real place, I feel like added a layer to it.
Thank you for this wonderful conversation. I have a question for Lily, because I think I guessed it for the other two writers. You know a lot about anthropology and politics and sociology. Do you have any conscious goal about talking about our times and the contradiction of our times when you wrote this novel, or was it something totally different for you? Because, and I would love, of course, the other two writers to say what they think about how present in their mind is the present political, social, world situation when they write a novel, in terms of politics, class, inequalities, racism, horrors. I mean, we live in a difficult time, and you all touch on something particular about your society and the group you describe. So I was curious, starting with Lily, because it didn't seem to be apparent as much as maybe in the other two, what is the role that I would say the social context, cultural context play, consciously or unconsciously? I mean, if it's unconscious, of course, there's nothing to say about it because it comes through your stories. But is it something you're aware of?
Is this for me? Yes.
It's mainly for you, but I would love the other two.
Well, I think looking back, you know, I have three examples of womanizers: Vaclav Havel, Philip Roth, Mario Vargas Llosa, all of them unfaithful, all of them leaving their wives for somebody else. Philip Roth, a misogynist, I think. And so I think that sort of speaks certainly to the scandals now, but as far as real politics go, no, I can't say that I address any of that, although I wish I could. I wish I could. Loud and clear about how unhappy I am. Yeah.
It was more about, you know, the fact that it's such an interesting idea about the second wife being obsessed with the first. It's something very much of our time, I would say.
What?
the question was, is it's very much of our time, the second wife.
Yes, definitely. And also the men being womenizers and unfaithful, yes.
Are there any more questions? Oh, one other. There's two more over here. Great, thank you.
This is for all three writers. I'm wondering, what was the most challenging part of structuring your book?
Okay.
We'll be here till at least 7.
The third floor, the main character in the third floor in this book is a judge. And she had to be a judge. There was no other choice. But I don't know nothing about judges. So at the beginning, I thought I can imagine how does a judge life look from inside and outside. And then I stopped after a couple of weeks, and I stopped writing, and I did went out for research. And this, again, was a bit tough because judges do not like to speak about their private emotions. They don't acknowledge emotions generally, and it was really tough to get judges to speak with me. Eventually, it was very fruitful because it led me to the plot of this floor. Because one of the judges I met with asked her, "What would be the first thing you would do after you retire on retirement day?" And she said, "I'm going to go to a demonstration." Because judges are not allowed to go to demonstrations. They are public servants. So this is the beginning of the plot of the third floor. And then the second thing she told me, this judge, I asked her, "Where are you living?" And she said, "I lived in Tel Aviv, but I moved out." I said, "Why did you move out?" And she said, "Because in a big city, wherever I'm going, I'm walking in the street, I'm afraid to meet somebody I sent to jail or someone from a family that of someone I sent to jail." So this is what happens to my judge. She goes to a demonstration, and then she meets someone who has an unclosed business with her. And without this, it was the toughest moment of writing, but it also led me into the plot.
In both of my novels, I'm really interested in the ways that the past influences the present and whether in the present you can ever kind of fully remove yourself from what's happened in the past. And so in both of my books, trying to figure out how to integrate those two things into the structure of the book was the hardest part. Because as we live our lives, the past is kind of always just layered over or under, depending on how you think about it, what you're going through, right? There isn't a moment where you stop and you just purely relive what was going on in the past, and then you come back and rejoin the world, and, you know, time continues on again. But in the novel, you have a lot more options. And so thinking about how to show the reader parts of the past that had to do with the present, you know, that had a bearing on the present, you know, do you do that through sort of having the character stop and time stops and they go back? Is there, you know, do you have a whole section of flashback? Do you have just moments? How do you hint at that? That was sort of the big problem that I had in both of my books.
I think I was very lucky with this book. It came very, very quickly. I wrote it very fast and I really had a good time writing it, which is a real joy. But just about research, I think in previous novels, one of my characters was a physicist, and I did a lot of research on physics, and now I love physics, but I think research is fun. I think making things up is hard, but the research is easy.
Thanks, and I think there was one more question. Yes, right there, right here. Well, they'll bring it down, because it's being audio recorded, please. Yes, thank you.
I actually had a question for Lily about if you feel there's any difference in the way that you attach to someone if they're no longer with us versus if there's still a presence in this world, just because of almost like the way that you're reading your book, in that you leave open spaces. If there are open spaces in a person's existence, you're filling them in yourself with your own sort of ideas and imagination. And in a world in which you can like look up people's exes online, you can see videos of them, you can like get actual real observations on them. If someone's no longer there for you to sort of see how they've moved on afterwards, to see how they are as a person, if you're filling in sort of your own perception of what your problems may be in like that relationship, and comparing yourself to something that may never have actually even been real, so to speak.
I'm not sure I understood the question at all. I'm sorry.
If if someone's missing, if it's more you're putting yourself into them than if they're still alive and you're able to actually see them, like, continue.
But all these characters are made up, so.
Right.
So. Sorry.
Oh, one. There's going to be one last question right down here. Thank you.
I didn't get that.
Okay. This is an easy one for Lily. You mentioned twice that it didn't take you very long to write the book. I'd be curious to know how long it took you.
About 2 months, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. It was wonderful. It was wonderful, yeah, yeah, yeah. And, I mean, I stopped working on something. Now I'm back on the other book. But I just felt, again, that I had to write this, and it came very fast. Yeah, yeah. It was fun.
Yes, it's embarrassing to admit. Writers love to say, I've worked 9 years about rewriting, and it happens. It
yes.
happened with other novels of mine, but The Three Floors Up was written in 6 months.
Yeah, but it
was
an
explosive process.
And
I did not write this book in 2 or 6 months. The actual writing down of it went fairly quickly. It took about a year and a half, 2 years, and I was really proud of myself until I went back and I looked at my notes. Because like most writers, I keep a notebook, and I realized that I had been working out bits of plot and bits of character on this on and off since 2009. And so that seems to be how long it took. I wasn't ready until then.
That's how long my books take. Great. Well, thank you. Oh, one last question up there. Yeah, okay, one more. Really last one.
I was interested if you were writing books, another book right now. you said that this took you from quite a bit of time. Do you write more than one book at a time?
I usually don't. Well, I started this book just before the last draft of my last book. I was having some problems with my last book, and I got this other idea, and I thought, that idea seems really great and really interesting and also really fun, and I think I know how to do that, and it will definitely not have any of the problems of this current book. And so I paused writing my first novel, and I just, you know, started taking notes on this, and at a certain point realized it had the exact same problems as my other novel, and I had to go back. So, I mean, I was just about to say no, but I guess then the answer is really yes. Right now, I have two ideas that are sort of, I'm sort of ping-ponging between, and I may end up writing two of them together. I don't know. But for me, I always think that I'm not. But I feel like we've always got ideas. You know, you're always picking up pieces of story, and you don't know what you're going to do with them. But something is going to happen. And so in that sense, you are always sort of working on a number of things at a time. I don't know if it's the same for the two of you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I write short stories, too, in between novels, usually. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I write lousy poems in between novels. Yeah.
Are you writing another novel now?
Yes. I send my novel to my editor, and she has this trick, and I fall in this trap every time, again and again. She says, she gets the manuscript, and she says, she writes me, perfect, the most well-built novel you ever written. There's really just tiny remarks. Just a few small, and then I got her second email a couple of days ago, and we have a lot of work.
Yeah, yeah. Great. Well, thank you so much, all three of you, and thank you for being here.